Oh, it's so good to be with you. And you may notice that we have a little bit of construction going on in our hallways, that we're really excited about the end result. So we're grateful for your patience in that. And we're also excited that that means we've got some elementary students and kids in our midst. If you're like between the ages of 2 and 10, can you raise your hand? 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Yeah, can you make a little noise? We're glad that you're here. Awesome. And parents, I just want to say to you that if you're a little nervous about them making a little noise and running around in the hallway, please put yourself at ease. Mine will probably be right there with them. But kids, I want to ask you a question. How many of you have a favorite like superhero or princess that you really admire or look up to? Is anyone here? Yeah? What are some examples of those people? You can shout them out. Sorry, you're not used to that. Cinderella, Batman, Elsa. Woo, okay. I want you guys to know that the grown-ups in this room, they also have some superheroes or some people that they look up to, people that they admire. And it might be a superhero, it might be the latest Wonder Woman version, it might be Batman, it might be someone they've met and known who has mentored them, it might even be somebody from the Bible. A lot of us have superheroes in the Bible, these people that we look up to, and we sort of think that they can sort of do no wrong. That's sort of how we so early on learn to idolize people and kind of set them on this pedestal. And when I think of some of the biblical characters that we do that to, I think we think, oh man, these Christians, these people, they're so filled with the Spirit. They have this direct line to God in prayer that I just don't have. We do that with people like the Apostle Paul. We do that with people from the Old Testament as well. And today we're going to hone in on David, who is one of our Old Testament characters of old that we tend to kind of idolize and lift up. And we're doing this summer series of Old Testament narratives where we're really trying to peel back the covers of some of these saints of old to ask, what can I learn about this person and their humanity and their story that applies to me? What do these stories that are thousands of years old, how do they relate to me today? What do they have for me? I'd say there's definitely a lot of good reason for some of David's superhero status. But let's go ahead and, can we just do a little backstory of the Old Testament first? And maybe even a little backstory to the summer, if you've sort of been in and out. We're going to call this sort of like Old Testament 101, Genesis through Samuel, in about 2 minutes. No pressure. Remember that God created the earth in Genesis 1, and he called it very, very good. And humans in it were made in his image, and also really, really good, very good. And then like 2 chapters later, humans decide, you know, I think I got this. I'm going to sort of take it into my own hands. And things started to go off the rails. And not to be worried, though, we get to Genesis 11 and 12, and we find out that God was calling Abram. His name changed to Abraham. And we learn that God said, you know what, Abram, through you, I'm going to bless the whole world. I'm going to make everything right again between me and my people through your people. And the whole wide world is going to be blessed through you. And so Abraham has a son named Isaac, and Isaac has a son named Jacob. And AJ did a teaching on the identity of Jacob. And ultimately, Jacob's name was turned to Israel. He had a name change. And Israel ended up having 12 sons or 12 tribes. And that's where we get our Israelites that we talk about, the people of God throughout the Old Testament. And that's where we're going to pick up our story. The thing about the Israelites is things had been going really well in the sense that God had been ruling them and guiding them and present with them. I mean, how many of us would just like want that kind of sign from God and that kind of direction from God? But you know what they did? They're like, you know what? Everyone else has an iPhone, we want an iPhone. Everyone else has a king, we want a king. And so God was like, all right, I'll give you a king. Your king is Saul. That was our first king of the Israelites. But Saul did not do so very well. And that's where we're going to pick up our text. Take a look at 1 Samuel 13 if you've got a Bible. I believe our ushers have been down. If you didn't grab a Bible, there's some Bible carts around the room. Page 260, if you're in the Shed Bibles. 1 Samuel 13, 11 to 14. This is Samuel. He's a prophet, a spokesperson for God, and he is speaking. He is speaking to Saul. Verse 11, "What have you done?" asked Samuel, and Saul gives his excuses in the next couple verses. Then Samuel says, "You have done a foolish thing. You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people, because you've not kept the Lord's command." Ultimately, it was determined that it was David who was going to be this man after God's own heart, the successor to Saul. And at first blush, it really is easy to see why David is given this superhero status. Many of us know these stories from long ago, even if we're not super familiar with the Bible. I mean, we know the story of David and Goliath, where there's this huge Philistine enemy, that he's a giant, his name is Goliath, and no one wants to defeat him, and no one dares, and no one can. And David says, "I'll do it, and I'm not going to put your armor on. I got my slingshot, I'm good to go, because I have the Lord on my side." And he does it. This is also the David who, a little bit later, God promises him that he is going to be an everlasting king. And what that means is God says, "You know what, David? There's always going to be somebody on the throne who's from your line, from your bloodline," which is unheard of during that day. And then how many of us, is the Psalms like our favorite book in the Bible? And David, of course, is the author of many of these Psalms. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." This is David. So of course we had uphold him. But this is also the David with a dark side. This is the David who's got multiple wives. This is the David who sees a woman from afar bathing on a rooftop and desires her and has her come to his home to have his way with her. And she becomes pregnant, and he does the noble thing. No. He has her husband killed, and then he takes her as his own. This is the same David. This is the same David whose sons go off the rails, and he's completely lenient with them, much to the peril of not only their family, but the whole Israelite nation. So here's what I'm interested in today, with all this in mind. I want to know how, even after this sort of sordid and mixed history, how is it that David is still upheld as this man after God's own heart? What in the world? And it's not only that we do it, Scripture itself does it. If you continue reading in the book of Kings, you'll find out that David is like this gold star, the gold standard by which other future kings are judged. You'll see over and over this type of language. "King so-and-so did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as his father David had done." To which you're like, really? We see 1,000 years later when the Apostle Paul in the New Testament is recounting all of redemptive and biblical history up to that point. He too talks about David as this man after God's own heart. And then in the book of Hebrews 11, where we have this list, we call it the Hall of Fame. Some people call it the Hall of Faith. All these heroes of faith over and over again. Many of them Old Testament people who like they're upheld as like the goal. And David is on that list. How can this be? And what does this mean for us? Lately, I've actually been thinking a lot about what it means to be human. So naturally, the story of David and the idea of not being just a man after God's own heart, but a human being after God's own heart, it's been really intriguing me. So today, that's really what I want to take a peek at. Like, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to see others as human? What is this, how does this impact the way we treat ourselves? How does this impact we treat other people? What does all this look like? So first, how to be human. And I have to say, even that phrase, I'm going to tell you how to be human, it feels super presumptuous to me, presumptive. So this is just what's been stirring in me, and I'm just going to share it out loud on what I think it means to be human. It strikes me that God was not unaware of David's character. God was not unaware of his propensities and his passions and his compulsions and his ability to be so prone to wander. I mean, even the psalmist says, God knows how we are formed. He knows we are dust. He knows our origins. God wasn't surprised by this. And I also have to think that the Apostle Paul, he would have known about David's history too. He would have known all about of redemptive history and David's flaws on his record. And there is no way that David sort of just snuck his way into the hall of faith in Hebrews 11. So here's what I'm coming to believe about being human. Being human is just a really mixed bag. Every one of us is sinner and saint, made in the image of God, and prone to wander. We are made of strength and struggle. We can do really beautiful things and really brutal things. One person coins this as brutiful. This is normal. This is human. And I honestly think that there can be a whole lot of peace when we can just acknowledge this and accept it. This sort of dual reality. And here's a tool that has sort of helped me with that. And it's the idea of permission slips. Do we have any Brené Brown fans here? This may be familiar to you. Brené Brown is a really popular author and speaker, and she talks about this idea of instead of pushing our big emotions and feelings and thoughts under the rug, to own and acknowledge them. And the tool that she herself has used is that of a permission slip. And she describes a scenario where she was going to go meet with and be on one of Oprah Winfrey's shows, I think it was Super Soul Sunday or something like that. And she was extremely excited, but she was also extremely nervous. So she gets out a piece of paper, a post-it note, and on it she writes this: permission to be excited, have fun, and be goofy. Sticks it in her pocket. You could have written, permission to be human. So I was reading about that section of her book a couple of summers ago during an interesting time in the life of our family. My husband and I were both looking for jobs, and it just so happened that the type of work he was looking for was really much more in the California area, and I was looking for jobs around here, and so he'd have an interview, I had an interview here. He'd have a second interview, I had another interview here. He had a third interview, I had a third interview here. I mean, we just didn't know what was going to happen. And I was holding all these emotions and feelings in, and eventually things sort of fizzled with California for him for the most part, but there's just this little spark of maybe someday. And I just had to give myself permission for two things. One, you get to be excited about the possibility of working at Marsail because that's really what you want to do. And two, you have permission to not know the future. Which sounds kind of ludicrous because of course no one knows the future. But I just needed to give myself permission to be human. And I have to tell you, it was so freeing to be human. What parts of your humanity, your own humanity, do you need to own and embrace and name and give yourself permission for? What freedom might there be in that? But this sort of mixed bag version of our human nature, it does bring up questions for me. So this is again more of like, oh man, as I'm ruminating on this, here's what comes up. One, what does it look like for me to lean more and grow toward more of the saint part of my humanity than the sinner part of my humanity? Like, I'm accepting it, sure, but I also want some growth. You know, this sanctification is a word you may have grown up with. What does it become to become more and more like the image of Jesus? But secondly, and I would say parallel for me, is what does it look like to do this in such a way that honors our humanity and doesn't cast shame? Say, look at who you are. Look at who you really are. And the answer is I don't actually know. But here's some maybe non-answers or what I think it doesn't look like. First of all, I don't think that following Jesus means making ourselves the enemy. Recently, I was listening to a podcast with Rob and Kristen Bell. They were founders of our church, you know, nearly 20 years ago. And Kristen said something that really resonated with me. She said, it's like I was taught that I was my own enemy. I couldn't trust myself or my body or my desires or any part of me in any way. I was an enemy unto myself. I was like, yeah, I think I picked that up too. Whether explicitly or implicitly. This is like Reformed theology on steroids. Total depravity, you are all sinner, no saint, end of story. And I think it's a result, actually, of going back to Genesis and really starting and focusing on Genesis 3, the fall, going our own way, our sinful nature, and forgetting that the Bible starts with Genesis 1, created in the image of God and very good. Where you start matters a lot. What if you're not a problem to God? What if you're not a problem to God? What if your humanity is a good thing? Can we just be reminded here that Jesus was 100% human? And already just a couple hundred years after he lived on earth, there is a major heresy called Docetism. And dose means to seem. And this heresy said, you know what, Jesus wasn't really human. Jesus just seemed like it. But really, he was totally God. And we had to reel that in and say, no. Jesus was 100% human. He had passion, emotion, desires, opinions, thoughts. Yet he was filled with the Spirit of God, of one mind with the Father. I think that's the kind of humanity we are going for. So first, you're not the enemy. You have inherent goodness and beauty. Now, secondly, I don't think that pursuing Christ-likeness means that somehow you have to lose yourself. In other words, that to become more like Jesus, you need to become less of you. That you somehow need to be obliterated. What does it mean for you to become more of who you were created to be? What if who you are is a good thing, intricately created in your mother's womb? What if your passions, your dreams, your desires, they matter? And they don't need to be neutered. What if your desires are not necessarily automatically and necessarily contrary to God's desires? What if those can coexist? Irenaeus from the second century, he says this, the glory of God is man fully alive. What makes you come alive? What if you get to ask this question? What do I think? What do I feel? What do I believe? What do I want to do? Here's a couple images I've been playing with as I've been just toying with all these questions in my head. And the first one is that of sort of rows of identical soldiers. Somewhere along the way, I feel like I picked up this idea that Christians were all supposed to walk in a straight line, precisely believing and behaving and thinking exactly the same way. Rows of identical soldiers. And that somehow if I got out of line, that God would be unhappy with me. But I've been playing with this image in contrast to that of children on a playground. I mean, imagine children running all over. There's not a script. There's not this straight line to walk in. There's trial and error for sure. Kids falling down and hurting themselves. There's individuality. There's community. There's playfulness. You get to develop and learn new skills. And, you know, this isn't to say that there's no guidelines or boundaries or whatever. And if you're a philosopher in the room, I'm sure you can poke all manner of holes in both of these analogies. But the image I'm getting at is that of freedom. Freedom. That's the image I'm going for. Eugene Peterson says this. And if that name sounds familiar, but you can't quite place it, he's the guy who did the Message translation of the Bible, so many of you have probably read his words without knowing it. Eugene Peterson says, "I'm not a Christian the same way you are. I'm not a Christian the same way you are. Although we all accept the same basis of fundamental truth and relationship, I'm not a Christian the same way you are." I think that's good news. Now, despite all these do's and don'ts, here's what I think David had going for him. Despite all of his ups and downs and his good, bad, and ugly decisions, he really was, in my understanding, a man after God's own heart. And I'm coming to believe this is why. I think more than any one decision or action, being a human being after God's own heart is a posture. It's an attitude. There's been a prayer by Thomas Merton that I've come back to again and again over the course of maybe the past 20 years when I first discovered it, and it's this. "My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, and nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you." I think that's the same thing as saying, "I am after your heart. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, will I trust you always. Though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death, I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. My desire to please you does, in fact, please you." I have found that as I've become more in touch with my own humanity, able to see myself as both sinner and saint and in process, it really has been like putting on a whole new set of lenses in the way that I look at other people and their humanity. And to be really honest with you, when I first started realizing this, I remember that week, actually, I was at work one day, and Troy, you were actually microwaving something for lunch. And I just looked at you from afar, pouring my coffee, and I was like, look at Troy. He's human. He's got good stuff. He's got bad stuff. He's human. I remember going to yoga that week. I'm, you know, in down dog, looking around. Look at all these humans in the room. I mean, it just opened my eyes to this common humanity of sinner and saint and created in God's image and prone to wander. And it gave me such freedom and grace in my view and treatment of other people. As I've been thinking about the ways that being human helps me see people, I came across this book by Jean Vanier called Becoming Human. You may be familiar with the LARCH or LARCH communities all around the world. There's about 150 of them, and this is where people with intellectual disabilities live in community with people who are not having those same troubles. They work together, play together, eat together. And here is what Jean Vanier says in his book, Becoming Human. One before that. "Believe it or not, it has been this life together, this living in community together, that has helped me become more human. Those I have lived with have helped me to recognize and accept my own weaknesses and vulnerability. I no longer have to pretend I am strong or clever or better than others. I am like everybody else, with my fragilities and my gifts. We are in a culture of competition. The strong, the beautiful, the intelligent, and the capable are magnified and extolled. These are our superheroes, the people we hold up. The weak and the vulnerable are often put aside, which I would say demonized. Our world is characterized by the huge gap between the rich and the poor, the oppressors and the oppressed, and by a continual horrible conflicts between national, ethnic, and religious groups. It's like there's this whole social pecking order, and we learn it really, really early, and we learn it really deeply. We learn early on in life that there are good guys and bad guys, that there are superheroes, and that there are evil people. There are people we idolize, and there are people we demonize. And when I say demonize, this is what I mean by that. To try to make someone or a group of people, could you go to the next slide, please? Two more, actually. There you go. Oh, one more. To try to make someone or a group of people seem completely evil. To equate a person's whole identity with one behavior or aspect about them. If you've been around here very long, you know that a couple years ago, we helped to launch HQ, which is a drop-in center for youth and young adults who are experiencing homelessness. And I noticed a shift in their language in the 2 years since they've been around. Maybe it might even be three by now. It goes quickly. But it used to be that we might say something like, Joe is homeless. And then I started noticing this shift when I heard it being talked about. Instead of Joe is homeless, like that's the only quality about Joe, I started hearing this language. Joe is experiencing homelessness. Joe is experiencing homelessness. And those are two different images and mental models. Joe is not wholly, that's not the only thing about who he is as a person fundamentally in his identity. He happens to be experiencing homelessness. He's down on his luck. There's a lot going on, but there's also a lot more wonderful things going on about him. There's a big difference between a set of actions or decisions and the whole of a person's identity. But we divide people into categories, and we do this early, and we do this often, and we do it innocently, and it's understandable. Like, I can't teach my 5 and 8-year-old all the nuances and shades of gray. It's much easier to break things into categories. And our brains naturally do that to make meaning of the things we're taking in. That's very normal. But here's the thing. It's got lasting impact. What we categorize early and innocently and inadvertently, things like good guys and bad guys, and all girls are this way, and all boys are this way. Over time, those things happen a little bit more persistently, a little bit more unconsciously, and that leads to stereotypes, it leads to prejudices, it leads to implicit biases that we don't even barely know we have. It is not without effect. So but before we kind of move on here, I just, you can keep that slide up here. I want to drill down a little bit into your own world, into your own life. What individuals in your life, if you're honest, are pretty easy for you to demonize? To equate maybe one set of actions or behaviors or decisions with the whole of who they are. Maybe it's your neighbor, a classmate, a coworker, your in-laws, your ex-husband. Maybe it's somebody in your section or your small group who just drives you nuts. What are the words you find yourself using to describe these people? Closed-minded? Jerk? Spineless? Crazy liberal? Etc. It's really easy. I do this too. It's really easy to write people off, to demonize them, to forget that there's so much more to their persona than those one or two things. We do this with groups too. Maybe there's whole groups of people that you're writing off and you're demonizing. Who are those people? Conservatives, liberals, Republicans, Democrats, Catholics, Protestants, charismatics, people who live in the suburbs, people who live in the city, millennials, octogenarians, transgender persons, people with tattoos, persons with a different skin color than you, Muslims. Who are those people? What are the words you find yourself associating with those groups of people? What do you wish, how do you wish they would be treated? Pay attention to those propensities to not only idolize and superhero people, but to demonize them. Again, what happens early, inadvertently, and innocently can shift to unconsciously and persistently, and then it can even be systematized and built into our rules and regulations and laws and our ways of treatment. So how we see impacts how we treat people. Historically in our country and in our world, when certain people are seen as the other, when they are demonized as a problem rather than a person, it has impacted the way that they have been treated, often in a very systemic way. Recently, I saw a film called 13th. It's a documentary. You can find it on Netflix for free. I highly recommend it. And what it does is it explores the 13th Amendment, which says there shall be no more slavery in the United States. And it explores this intersection of race and justice and our prison population. And here's some stats that I didn't know anything about. The United States is home to 5% of the world's population, 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's prisoners. African Americans make up 6% of the American population, 6% of the population, but African Americans make up 40% of our prison population. While a white male has a 1 in 17 chance of ending up behind bars, for a black male, it is 1 in 3. And I think oftentimes people who are incarcerated have been solely demonized, solely written off for an action or a series of actions and behaviors, rather than looking at the whole picture of who they are and the image of God in each of them. This film looks at the ways we see people and then how we treat people in a very systemic way. And I'd like to just play one quote for you, one clip, Lord willing.
Having people truly understand that when Black lives matter, everybody's life matters, including every single person that enters this criminal justice system and this prison industrial complex. It's not just even about only Black lives, right? It's about changing the way this country understands human dignity.
That's what really this Black Lives Matter moment is about. This question of whose life do we recognize as valuable?
Opposite of criminalization is humanization. That's the one thing I hope that people will understand.
It's about rehumanizing us as a people and us, right, as a people, all of us.
It's about human dignity. Whose life do we recognize as valuable? It's about the rehumanizing of all of us. Of all of us. What does that even mean? What does that even look like to rehumanize each other? Yourself first, perhaps, but then the people in your sphere of influence and those you might consider as the other. What does that mean? What does that look like? And I think we can head back to our text for this. If we look at Genesis 1 again, we remember that we, each and every one of us, were created in the image of God. We were created very good. Even those people that drive you crazy, even those groups of people who are completely different than you, that you don't agree with, that you're afraid of, made in the image of God. This is who we are. I have a friend, or we have a colleague actually here at Mars Hill, who she was talking the other day about how she plays sort of this private game of hide and seek. So that in every person she meets, she finds herself looking for, mining for, trying to pull out the image of God in each and every single person that she sees. What a beautiful spirit of curiosity. That's something we can do. That's tangible. Maybe it's more of a spirit of generosity. Actually, we have a sign or a picture framed in our living room. It looks like this. It says, "Be kind. Everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle." Be kind. Everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle. And this reminds me, maybe that person at the grocery store I encountered who's super cranky, or the person who dropped me off in or cut me off in traffic, or maybe for you it's somebody who didn't pay rent on time or whatever. Those people are fighting hard battles that you may not know anything about. That's to be human. So cultivating the spirit of curiosity and generosity toward the other, putting other people in their proper place. But secondly, I think it's about putting God in God's proper place. Simply put, God is God and we are not. And that is good news. We are human. I don't think God is actually expecting us to be God. God knows that that's the case, that we are human, God is God, and that's kind of how it's designed to be. Can we go back to Acts? Let's go to Acts 13, 22 to 23. I've got it here on the screen. If you've got a Bible, you're welcome to look it up. Page 10, 20, 17 in the New Testament. Just back to the story of David. After removing Saul, this is Paul when he's recounting all of redemptive history and telling us about the history of the Israelites. After removing Saul, God made David their king. God testified concerning him, "I have found David, son of Jesse, a man after my own heart. He will do everything I want him to do." And again, I'm like, seriously? But verse 23, this is God's perspective on the matter. "From this man's descendants, God has brought to Israel the Savior Jesus, as he promised." Remember, David's kingship, David's leadership, David's life, good, bad, and ugly, is part of the larger story. He is part of that line of Abraham, and God promised, God covenanted with Abraham, and he said, no matter what, everybody on the earth is going to be blessed through you. I'm going to show everyone what I am like, what my love is like through you and your line. That's what's going on with David. David was told, there's going to be a king coming from your line who's going to rule forever and ever, amen. That was Jesus. And through Jesus, God shows us his love. He fulfills this promise. No matter what, God is going to bless and love and care for all people. And David was part of that, whether he knew it or understood it or followed along with the plan. My kids and I, we like to read this version of the Bible called the Jesus Storybook Bible. And here's how they describe God's covenant love, and I love it. You see, no matter what, in spite of everything, God would love his children with a never stopping, never giving up, unbreaking, always and forever love. That is our God. It seems to me that this is the God that David knew. This is the God that David's heart was oriented after. Yes, he was human. But he was a human after this God, after this God's heart. So at the end of the day, maybe David wasn't a superhero. He was a human. And maybe we get to be that way too. I'd like to invite Aaron up and just spend a little bit of time in reflection and prayer together. I'd invite you to close your eyes and maybe even open up your hands as a gesture of openness and receiving. Oftentimes, we give ourselves the short end of the stick. We're super critical about ourselves, perhaps despairing over those things that will never change. Why don't you, with your open hands, imagine those qualities about yourself that are hard for you to like or accept, or the things that you feel tentative about, your desires, your feelings. Name them without judgment. Just name them, hold them, offer them to God. And receive this message with your open hands as well. You are loved. You are made in God's image. Your thoughts, your feelings, your desires matter. You are not a problem to God. You have divine DNA. And now imagine in your hands an image of a person or a group of people that are hard for you to love or to understand. Maybe it's a group or a person that you demonize. Even maybe notice how you feel in your body as you think of this person or this group. And say this silently, as if this person or this group were right in front of me, in front of you. I'll say it once and again. The image of God in me greets the image of God in you. The image of God in me greets the image of God in you. God, every single one of us here has a story. A story of strength and struggle, of brokenness and triumph, of dreams and desires, hopes and expectations. Please take all of it. Work on us, meet us where we are. Help us to become the people you created us to be. Thank you, God, that that is your job and not ours. Help us to cooperate by the work of your Spirit. In your name we pray.